John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Shireen Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 and 30 seconds right there on the dot. Coming up next is your Friday evening news, but first this.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Art of the Guillotine and other class horror stories on Friday, October 5th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the AFRU Gallery in Portland. In this exhibit, Shane Bugby has created a variety of handmade flags with messages for the powers that be. Sculptural works that include $10,000 of real shredded U.S. currency, detention center Liberty Shanks, and a life-size model of a guillotine. The opening features snacks, cake, and interactive performances. Again, that's The Art of the Guillotine and other class horror stories on Friday, October 5th, from 6 to 10 p.m. at the AFRU Gallery, 534 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Palestinian Film Festival, October 5th to the 7th, at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in downtown Portland. From Friday evening to Sunday afternoon, the theater will feature films by and about Palestinians and the Israeli occupation.
The Stones Cry Out, a film about Palestinian Christians, will play on Friday, October 5th. Then, The Wanted 18, about the nonviolent struggle in Beit Sahur and the herd of 18 cows that Israel deemed a national security threat.
The Occupation of the American Mind, Steadfast Hope, and more.
You can find a link to tickets for the event on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Guess what, KBOO listeners? It's 5:01 on a Friday, which means it's time for your KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levine and Levine, LLP attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levine and Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levineandlevine.com. And now it's time for your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Kavanaugh's confirmation seems assured tomorrow.
A Chicago police officer has been found guilty of murder.
And Congress is attempting to privatize the Postal Service.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 5th, 2018.
I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
Citing concerns about fairness, the last Republican holdout announced today that she would support the appointment of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Senator Susan Collins announced today she will vote in favor of President Donald Trump's pick, virtually ensuring his confirmation when the full Senate holds its final vote on Saturday. Quote, "It is when passions are most inflamed, when fairness is most in jeopardy," Collins said. "I worry that departing from this presumption could lead to the lack of public faith in the judiciary and would be hugely damaging to the confirmation process moving forward," end quote. Earlier in the day, she had been visited by 20 Kavanaugh women supporters in her office as opposed women protested loudly outside and held a sarcastic kegger party. Standing just a few feet from each other, the opposing groups shouted shame to each other. Capitol Police report that a woman allegedly assaulted a man outside of Collins' office. Earlier, Senator Jeff Flake had announced that he, too, would vote for Kavanaugh. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin has also announced his support for the ultra-conservative judge, and now the only holdout on the Republican side is Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. The resulting 5-4 conservative majority is widely expected to destroy regulation of business, roll back freedoms for GLBTQ persons, and attack access to abortion.
Minutes after Susan Collins announced that she would vote in favor of Kavanaugh, the crowdfunding site that had been set up to oppose her crashed. The site was set up by a progressive grassroots organization that asked people to pledge support for Collins' opponent if she voted yes on the Supreme Court nominee. When she did, donations poured in so fast that the site was overwhelmed and it crashed. At last count, the total was well over $2 million. Amy Halstead, co-director of the Maine People's Alliance, said, quote, "The vote is a complete betrayal of Maine voters. I don't think Mainers will forget this," end quote. Collins won re-election in Maine in 2014 with 67% of the vote, but there has been a serious drop in her local popularity since then. An August poll showed that less than half of the voters had a favorable opinion of the Maine Republican. Halstead said the money will go to whoever is the Democratic challenger in 2020. Possible candidates include former Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards and former UN Ambassador Susan Rice.
It's time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you think our government's war policy has become out of this world cuckoo, consider the spaciness being proposed by the cosmonauts on Spaceship Trump. Spending nearly $700 billion a year on maintaining the five branches of the U.S. war machine, not counting the cost of actually fighting all the wars they get into, is not enough, they now tell us. So, prepare to soar, militarily and budgetarily, into a boundless war theater where none have gone before. Yes, outer space! It seems that Captain Trump himself woke up one morning in June and abruptly announced that he was bored with the fusty old Army, Air Force, etc., so he wanted a shiny new sixth military branch to play with. A space force to carry America's war-making power to a cosmic level. His loyal lieutenant, Mike Yes Man Pence, promptly saluted, calling Trump's whim an idea whose time has come. America's military leaders rolled their eyes at this folly, but they've since snapped to attention and are preparing to launch Captain Trump's grandiose space dreams. In a melodramatic speech, Pence declared that the new space command will, quote, "seek peace in space as on Earth." That's not very comforting. However, he says he's thrilled that Trump's Space Force will be led by a four-star general, have its own bureaucracy with a multi-billion-dollar budget, have a separate division to funnel money to corporate war contractors, and have its own snappy uniforms. Won't all that look great if Trump ever gets that big showy military parade he's been demanding as a tribute to his leadership as a cocktail room warrior? This is Jim Hightower saying, the Trumpeteers gush that this extraplanetary extravagance will attract, quote, "America's best and bravest to serve us as war fighters." Of course, their privileged families won't have to fight in any of the space wars they're dreaming up for other families to fight.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A memorial walk on Monday will honor 45 children who died at the Rapid City Indian Boarding School in South Dakota. It will take place on the city's west side. Lee Strubinger has a preview of the walk.
The Rapid City Indian Boarding School was opened from 1898 to 1933 and part of a federal government policy of forced assimilation for Native children. The building is now an Indian Health Service hospital. Heather Don Thompson is with the Minnelusahan Okolokichiapi Ambassadors Group. Thompson's working on identifying those who've died at the school. So far, about 45 have been identified, two of which were infants. She says children who passed away at the school were noted as, quote, "no longer being enrolled."
Many family members were never notified. Their children simply never came back. There are a handful of graves that are marked that are at the Mountain View Cemetery here in Rapid City, but that's only 9 of the children. We know that some of the children did make it home. Their families were notified on time, and they are buried back at home. But there's a pretty significant portion that are most likely buried in unmarked graves near the school.
Thompson says more than the 45 being honored died at the school. She says the frustrating part about documenting the children who died is how unimportant it was to the federal government. In addition to the memorial walk, Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender has proclaimed this year's Native American Day as the Day of Grandmothers. The walk takes place Monday morning at 9 a.m. and starts at Sioux Park and makes its way to the Sioux San Hospital. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
A number of activities are planned Monday in Los Angeles to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. This year marks the first official holiday in L.A. after the city council moved to replace Columbus Day and instead recognize Indigenous people. City Council member Mitch O'Farrell introduced the motion and led the 2-year process to change the day.
It was critical for Los Angeles to act and act in the manner that we did with the repeal of Columbus Day and the replacement of Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday of October. We're the largest population of any city or state to have done so.
O'Farrell says events will also include serious undertones with panel discussions looking at issues facing Native people.
We acted because the Native American population, Indigenous people, have been, you know, the atrocities committed during colonization have resulted in some very, very sobering statistics. And we need to lift up Native people, Indigenous people, who have been living with the results of 500 years of colonization. But the bottom line in all of this is that this is a celebration. It's not going to be a down day. We're not going to pretend that there aren't issues that we have to deal with in Native America, but we're going to celebrate the fact that we're elevating the profile of the needs that persist in Native America.
The day will begin with a sunrise ceremony and end with a concert featuring Redbone and the Black Eyed Peas. The Navajo Nation has declared a state of emergency for part of its reservation in Arizona after rain from Tropical Storm Rosa damaged a road. One person died in an accident Wednesday night where a section of the highway was washed out between the cities of Flagstaff and Page. Transportation agencies are repairing the highway, which is expected to be closed for several days. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
From northern Minnesota, Red Lake Nation Foods is pleased to support this show and share the bounty of the harvests, wild rice products, and wild fruit jams, jellies, and syrups produced by American Indians and available at redlakenationfoods.com.
And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska, and online at sanofsky.com.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio with Davey D. Tonight's weather forecast is for a low of 51 degrees, with rain becoming lighter and less frequent tomorrow, when the high temperature is expected to be 65 degrees. Today in history, the Northern Ireland Troubles began as a few hundred civil rights protesters walked from Duke Street in the predominantly Protestant waterside area of Derry to the Diamond in the center of the city. Duke Street had been declared out of bounds, and marchers were violently confronted by rows of police officers from the Royal Ulster Constabulary. The quote of the day is from Northern Ireland activist Bernadette Devlin, who said of the time that we're speaking of, "If you reflect back on it, the explanation for me is that this is a militarist philosophy, afraid of democracy. It doesn't trust the people. The parties work in the government in exactly the same way. It's not that they don't understand democracy. They don't believe in it. And the institutions that arise from that are institutions of control." End quote.
Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke was found guilty today of second-degree murder in the 2014 shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. The panel of 8 women and 4 men was made up of 7 white, 1 black, 3 Hispanic, and 1 Asian juror. In addition to the murder charge, Van Dyke was found guilty of 16 counts of aggravated battery, 1 count for each of the 16 bullets he fired into McDonald. Jurors reported that they thought Van Dyke's testimony was not credible and seemed rehearsed. They also noted that he did nothing to de-escalate the situation and began firing within 6 seconds of his arrival on the scene. Prosecutors pointed to the fact that prior to his arrival, Van Dyke told his partner, quote, "I guess we'll have to shoot him," end quote. Van Dyke is the first Chicago police officer to be charged and found guilty of murder since 1980. The Chicago Fraternal Order of Police said they will appeal the ruling, and Union President Kevin Graham said, quote, "The Chicago Police Department is standing with an officer we think acted as an officer."
And now, here's an excerpt from today's shortwave report, recorded from international broadcast by Dan Roberts. The first story is by NHK in Japan about radiation at the Fukushima plants. Radio Havana, Cuba presents a story about the effects of sanctions in North Korea. And Russia's Sputnik has information about the International Court of Justice and the incarceration of Alberto Fujimoro in Peru.
Tokyo Electric Power Company has admitted that much of the water stored at its crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant has not been treated thoroughly enough for release into the sea. How to dispose of the ever-increasing amount of radioactive water at the plant is a pressing matter. More contaminated water is constantly being generated by the process used for cooling the damaged reactors at the plant. Before being stored in tanks at the plant, the water undergoes treatment. This is supposed to remove all radioactive substances except tritium, which is difficult to extract. One of the ideas that has been proposed for reducing the stock of tainted water is to release some of it into the sea. The plant is located on the Pacific coast of northeastern Japan. But many at a public hearing in August opposed the plan. Some people pointed out that the water in question also contains other radioactive elements. At a meeting of experts in Tokyo on Monday, officials of the utility company reported that as of August, there was 890,000 tons of such water at the plant. They said they suspect that more than 80% of the water contains not only tritium, but also other radioactive substances. These include iodine and strontium, according to the experts, at levels exceeding government-set limits for release into the environment. A senior Tokyo Electric official apologized, saying his company was too focused on the issue of tritium and failed to provide a full explanation.
The president of the United Nations Security Council has suggested that exceptional measures should be considered to ensure that sanctions against North Korea don't affect people's lives in the country. Bolivia's UN ambassador, Sasha Llorente, said at a news conference in New York on Wednesday that Security Council members believe that sanctions should not affect the lives of citizens and that a sanctions committee dealt with humanitarian exceptions in its previous meeting. He indicated that such measures will possibly be discussed by a committee to monitor whether sanctions are properly observed. The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted the resolution to impose sanctions on North Korea. But stark differences in positions are emerging amid North Korea's active engagement with the leaders of South Korea and the United States. The United States insists that the sanctions should remain in place, while Russia and China are arguing for easing the punitive measures.
The International Court of Justice has ordered the United States to ensure that its sanctions on Iran do not affect trade in humanitarian goods. The U.S. government vowed to resume economic sanctions against Tehran starting in August. The Iranian government filed a lawsuit with the ICJ in The Hague in July, saying the sanctions violate a bilateral treaty. Judges at the ICJ noted on Wednesday that limiting sales of humanitarian goods such as medicine and food may have a serious detrimental impact on the health and lives of individuals in Iran. The judges pointed out that movement of goods required for humanitarian needs stalled after foreign financial companies pulled out their operations from Iran. They ordered the U.S. to remove any impediments to trade in such goods. They also called for the removal from the U.S. sanctions list of spare parts and equipment necessary to ensure the safety of civil aviation. Iran's foreign ministry said in a statement that the country welcomes the ICJ decision. It also said the decision proves that the U.S. sanctions against the people of Iran are oppressive. Peru's Supreme Court has annulled a medical pardon granted to former President Alberto Fujimori and ordered he be returned to prison. The top court on Wednesday ruled the pardon was unlawful and ordered the former president to serve out the remainder of a 25-year sentence. The court explained its reasoning after weighing his crimes against humanity. Fujimori had been in prison for 10 years when he was released on humanitarian grounds last December. He has been staying at home and hospital since then. Fujimori, a Peruvian of Japanese descent, became president in 1990. But he was ousted in 2000 as public criticism mounted over his heavy-handed governing style. He was later convicted of human rights crimes for his role in the killing of citizens by security forces while in office. Some observers see a political dimension to the decision. They speculate that it seeks to harm the chances of the opposition party, led by Fujimori's daughter Keiko, in local elections scheduled for this weekend. Her party is reportedly in the lead.
That was Dan Roberts' shortwave report with broadcasts from Japan, Cuba, and Russia.
Efforts are underway in Congress to privatize the U.S. Postal Service. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke today with Jamie Partridge to find out more.
I'm here with Jamie Partridge of Communities and Postal Workers United and a retired postal worker. There is a rally coming up. I'd like to ask you about it. It's called U.S. Mail Not For Sale. Why the rally?
Because the U.S. mail is not for sale. The Trump administration, in their latest or one of their latest outrages, is proposing the privatization of the U.S. Postal Service. That is, selling it off to their corporate for-profit buddies, which of course would be disastrous for service, for costs, and for jobs. A national treasure of the U.S. Postal Service getting sold off to Wall Street.
Is this a follow-up on the effort from several years ago to poison the finances of the Postal Service by demanding that the retirement be funded decades in advance?
75 years in advance.
So people who aren't born, their retirement is being set up now by the demands of the U.S. Congress.
Well, it's part of actually decades-long. The first real assault began during the Reagan administration when the Reagan administration attempted a full-on privatization of the Postal Service. But since that time, it's been piecemeal attempts, some successful, some not successful, to outsource to the private sector pieces of this universal service, which reaches from the outback in Alaska to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. You know, 150 million addresses in the United States. Everybody gets the same service at the same affordable, efficient way, 6 days a week by mail and 7 days a week through parcels. And of course, it's a socialist project, so it has to be eliminated. No, that's not the reason. The reason is because it's a $67 billion business, which is not losing money, but what the private sector would love to profit off of it. And what's been happening is the Congress passed that Postal Enhancement and Accountability Act in 2006. In the middle of the night, by a voice vote, to force the Postal Service to put 10% of its budget, $5.5 billion a year, away in this stash, you know, for retiree health benefits, which has been putting the Postal Service further and further in debt every year. So
now they can say, oh, the Postal Service is getting further and further in debt, so we've got to get rid of it.
Well, not just that, but there have been half the mail processing plants have been closed in the last 5 years. That's had a huge impact on mail delivery. In fact, mail is being delayed because, we used to be able to put mail in, first-class mail in the box one day in Portland, and it would be delivered the next day in Portland. Now it takes 2 days.
All because of this poison pill.
Right.
Well,
but also it's an agenda, which, again, but even before this poison pill of 2006, they attempted to contract out letter carrier routes in new developments to the private sector. They've successfully privatized trucking over the road to the private sector. There have been attempts to install private post offices, for example, in the Staples office supply chain. The Postal Service set up a program where post offices were set up with private sector Staples employees getting, you know, high turnover, low wage, supplanting living wage union jobs. We fought that for 3 years and successfully reversed it. But the other piecemeal privatization has been successful, including some of the maintenance, janitorial, that kind of thing. Since the Reagan administration, this is the first full-on assault on attempting to privatize the whole Postal Service. But with the private sector, there's no way that a private for-profit company could charge the same price and provide the same service in rural areas that they do in the urban areas. Currently, the urban areas subsidize the rural areas.
Has local response been good to this rally coming up?
Yeah, they've been called by the postal unions, but there are also a number of different organizations from seniors groups who depend, and veterans groups that really depend on the Postal Service for things like pharmaceuticals for the mail, to rural organizations and to low-income community groups where folks who are not as dependent on the internet or the different digital means of communication to depend on the Postal Service. Of course, the Postal Service is a huge supporter of e-commerce. The mail mix has been changing from first-class mail to parcel delivery because of e-commerce. And so we actually have quite a few of the millennials or the younger generation that are very supportive of the Postal Service and who are promised to show up for our rally.
Okay, well, can you repeat then the information that is to be held on the 8th?
It's held on Monday, the 8th of October. Which is a federal holiday, Columbus Day, also known as Indigenous Peoples Day, so that the postal workers have it off. So we're rallying at noon from 12 to 12:30 at congressional offices of Representatives Blumenauer and Wyden, Senator Wyden, at 911 Northeast 11th. That's near Holiday, and it's a rally against privatization of the Postal Service. U.S. Mail, not for sale.
Thank you very much, Jamie Partridge. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Teresa Mitchell speaking with Jamie Partridge.
Will Vinton, a Portland resident and the creator of the beloved California Raisins claymation characters, died this week of advanced multiple myeloma. Vinton produced a trilogy of the 27-minute fairy tales in the late 1970s and early 1980s. They include Martin the Cobbler, the Oscar-nominated Rip Van Winkle, and The Little Prince. These films were later released theatrically under the umbrella title Trilogy and later to video as The Little Prince and Friends. In 1978, Vinton produced the documentary Claymation, three-dimensional clay animation, a 17-minute film featuring the behind-the-scenes technical processes used. The term claymation was later trademarked by Vinton and has become synonymous with clay animation in general. Prominent among his hundreds of now international commercial creations were the California Raisins, the Domino's Pizza Noid, and the M&M's characters. Vinton's family wrote on Facebook, quote, "He saw the world as an imaginative playground full of fantasy, joy, and character. He instilled in us the greatest values of creativity, strength, and pride in one's own work. He created stories and characters filled with laughter, music, and powerful lessons that are globally beloved. He brightened any room with his signature mustache, and he continued to make jokes and laugh until the very end. His work will live on in animation history and will continue to inspire creative thinkers and makers. End quote. Listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 5th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Teresa Mitchell and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Teresa Mitchell, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, On the Ground Radio, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes the Center for Biological Diversity to discuss the current state of wolf recovery in the Northwest. And at 11, Making Contact looks back 10 years after the crash with Nomi Prinz and discusses her new book, Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Linda. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, Jasmine. Good night, Jenna.
Good.